Well, let's open up our Bibles at Matthew chapter 19. Sometimes you're put into those situations that you have to talk about things that you just don't really want to talk about at all. It can be awkward and embarrassing and even annoying situations. I was on a conference about 2 weeks ago now, a counseling conference up in Derbyshire. And there's a few sessions, and every session they stopped, sometimes twice, sometimes three times a session, and they said, right, discuss with the person next to you for 2 or 3 minutes what you think about what's been said, how you feel about it, and how it applies. I hate that kind of thing. I just don't like it at all. Totally out of my comfort zone. I might be next to a smelly man or a really nice-smelling female. And I find both situations awkward for different reasons. And I just don't want to talk about it. I'm like a clam in many ways. My family would tell you that. Awkward. It's the same sometimes the last night they had confession night. Okay, this counseling conference. Halfway through the service, the guy that was leading worship was saying, right, soon we're going to have confession time. And I thought, well, that's great. If someone's going to lead this from the front about confession, that'll be good. Yeah. Sure enough, it came. We'll turn to the person next to you. Get them to pray for you and share with them. I thought, oh boy, I can have fun with this. Natasha from Nidri was sitting in front of me, and I leant over and said into her ear, I'm going to invent something really juicy. And I felt like saying to the person next to me, confession, really like your legs. I didn't say that, though, at all. But I really felt like it, because it's just, that's the kind of thing brings out the worst in me. Now, I don't like those situations. So, you know, I just don't do that here. Sometimes on a Wednesday night, but I always make the questions objective. Sometimes around the meal table as well, there might be sensitive subjects being spoken about. Subjects that might embarrass you or make you cross or that you've actually been hurt by in the past. And you get all anxious and agitated about it. Situation here that Jesus faces is awkward. Divorce. And I wonder if Jesus actually found this an awkward situation as well. The Pharisees had cornered Jesus in Matthew chapter 19. They'd forced him into a conversation which I think that perhaps he'd rather not have had in public. The topic of the conversation is as follows. The topic and the test in verse 3. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? I suggest that Jesus would have preferred to speak about this in private, in teaching, rather than in the public square. But it's such an upsetting and such a horrible thing, the subject and reality of divorce. And I suggest that Jesus was probably a little uncomfortable in speaking about this because he's so aware of people's feelings. And yet it seems that the Pharisees are just really callous about it all. Right there, right out there in the public, come on, Jesus, let's talk about divorce. No matter who's been through it and who's been hurt by it and who's trying to recover from it, doesn't matter who's listening to us, come on, Jesus, let's talk about divorce. And basically, when they're asking him about divorce, it's not because they want to find out the answer. They're actually, it says here, they came to test him. In verse 3, some Pharisees came to test him. Why? Well, maybe they could actually split his followers in the answer that he would give, because this is still a subject that splits churches and Christians today, subject of divorce. So in getting Jesus to give an answer to this question, they were thinking, well, maybe we can divide the crowds here. If he says one thing, then half the crowd would go away. If he said another thing, the other half of the crowd would go away. It was a no-win situation for Jesus. So they came to test him, probably to damage his followers and damage his reputation. Also, you notice in verse 1 that Jesus had crossed over to the other side of the Jordan. So he was now in Herod's territory. And the whole Herod and Herodias scandal was a public issue. Herodias had left her husband to marry Herod Antipas. And John the Baptist had lost his head for condemning this. So Jesus, let's talk about divorce. Let's test you. No, they just wanted to make things awkward for Jesus. They wanted to catch him out in his words. They weren't really interested in what he had to say, apart from whether he would ruin his followers. It's really callous on the part of the Pharisees. They're using a devastating human situation to test Jesus. Divorce is an awful thing in a fallen world. It's traumatic. It leaves scars that sometimes never heal. It can rip families apart. Divorce can ruin children for the rest of their lives. Divorce can mentally and emotionally disable adults for a long, long, long time. Divorce hurts. It's usually always messy, and it's horrible. And the Pharisees heartlessly use it to test Jesus. You know, as churchgoers, we need to make sure that we're not like this. Some churchgoers can take the most upsetting and hurtful ethical situation and simply debate it and to test people with it without a thought for those who have suffered the situation that they're talking about. What's the test? Well, they probably wanted to find out which kind of rabbi Jesus followed. For in those days, there were two famous rabbis, and each of them had their own disciples and their own schools of thought, and each of them had different views on divorce. So there was the rabbi called Shammai, who took a very strict rule about divorce, and he and his followers said it was only allowed for sexual impurity. Then there was another school of thought led by a rabbi called Hillel, who was much more lenient and who says you could divorce for any reason. If your wife burns the dinner, if she talks too much, and if you've gone off her, well, just easy and simple, just chuck her. And it was that view that was actually dominant in the day. It was a male-ruled society. It's terrible. And these Pharisees who were asking Jesus about this, they didn't really want the answer. They just wanted to know which side Jesus came down on, Hillel or Shammai. And that would really split the followers. So how does Jesus answer this question? Let's think about the Bible in the beginning. Jesus goes straight back to the scriptures, verse 4. "Haven't you read?" he replied. And of course, he knew that they had, because they were Pharisees, so they knew their what we call the Old Testament really well. And Jesus is quoting from the very second chapter of Genesis. "Haven't you read," Jesus replied, "that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they're no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate." This was always Jesus' method. What does the Bible say? What does the scripture say? Let's go back to the scriptures. Doesn't matter what Shammai says. Doesn't matter what Hillel says. Let's see what God says. And Jesus quotes from Genesis. He speaks about the Creator God in verse 4 and how things were at the beginning of time in verse 4 as well. And he speaks about God's created order and design. It says the Creator. So he believed in God, the Creator. He made them male and female. God made two genders, male and female, quite distinct from each other, made them for different purposes. He made them equal, but with different roles. And they were perfectly suited for each other in marriage, easily to become one flesh and reproduce after their kind. And Jesus says in verse 5, "For this reason a man will leave his father and mother." Well, for what reason? Well, for the reason he just gave in verse 4, that God made them male and female. Well, for this reason, there can be marriage. Because God created two compatible genders two compatible bodily forms so that marriage could be marriage and children could be born. Now, this union, Jesus says, should not come to an end in this world, for it really is to death as do part. Being one flesh is the way they should stay. Marriage is lifelong. God has joined them together. Don't let any person separate them. And that's what he says at the end of verse 6. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. God has designed this. God has created male and female for this very reason. So what God has joined together, don't let one separate. Now that, in choosing to go straight back to the scriptures in the beginning of time, then that should close the discussion. Should be over. God has spoken. One woman, one man, to be one flesh in marriage for as long as both shall live. That's the Creator's design, and it's a beautiful design. So there's nothing to misunderstand, is there? Well, the Pharisees won't quite let it go. They press the issue, verse 7. Why then, they asked, they think they're being really clever here, why then did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? Now, in doing that, they're quoting from the book of the law, the Torah, and Deuteronomy chapter 24. I'll read it to you. If a man marries a woman, said Moses, who becomes displeasing to him because he finds something indecent about her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, gives it to her, and sends her away. That's the passage they're quoting, Deuteronomy 24 and verse 1. And these Pharisees are saying to Jesus, if divorce and remarriage is not God's design, then why did Moses allow it and write it in the law of God? Well, Jesus then puts them right in their interpretation of Moses. See, they speak of a command in verse 7. Why then did Moses command this? But Jesus says, you've got it wrong. It's not a command. It's a permission. Verse 8. Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it wasn't this way from the beginning. See, they speak of a command. Jesus speaks of a permission. What Moses was doing was simply regulating and making orderly without necessarily agreeing with the way that people were divorcing each other, particularly the way that men were treating women. So for the protection of the woman in a male-dominated society, the Old Testament, for the protection of the woman, there must be a certificate of divorce. You can't just throw her away. You've got to respect her. And Moses would say that isn't ideal and that shouldn't happen, but it is happening and we can't do much about it. So let's try to protect the vulnerable woman. You can't just throw her away. You must sit down, think about it, and give a certificate of divorce. Now, Moses didn't necessarily agree with this, but he permitted it. He conceded to it, A, to slow the process down, B, to protect the honor of the woman. But what Jesus says in the last part of verse 8 is, well, actually, the real reason for divorce is that your hearts are hard. Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts are hard. Sin is the reality behind this. The ideal is what Jesus has just said in verses 4 to 6, one man, one woman together for life. The non-ideal, but the sad reality of living in a fallen world is often divorce. And Jesus speaks of allowance, not of command. Divorce is all because of the hardness of the human heart towards God in the marriage relationship. Sadly, that's true today as well. Disciples of Jesus who are married will seek with all their heart to maintain their marriage. They seek to work at it, to develop it, to make it something absolutely beautiful and enjoyable, to make their marriage a picture of Jesus and the church. But tragically, because of the hardness of the human heart and the presence of sin, some marriages break down. And they sometimes break down to such an extent that it results in divorce. And when this happens, it's because of sin and the hardness of the human heart, not because of the design of God's creation. Every divorce is the result of at least one person having their heart so hard against the other person and God. Sometimes it's both people with hardness of heart. It's always messy. It's always difficult. But Moses permitted it because sometimes to live in such marriage circumstances is totally unbearable. But it's not God's design. In Malachi, God says, I hate divorce. And divorce is never the first go-to thing when marriages get difficult. All marriages go through difficulties and tensions. That's a fact of life. Every marriage does. But don't think that divorce is the easy option. It was not God's plan from the beginning, and it may lead to further sin in the future. For Jesus gives a stern warning in verse 9. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. See, what Jesus is doing here is to acknowledge that divorce takes place because of sin and the hard heart. He says that in verse 9, I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife. So he acknowledges, like Moses, that it goes on. He acknowledges that. It's a sad reality of a fallen world. But Jesus goes a little bit further and says that if remarriage takes place after divorce, then it leads to adultery. Except for one reason. Listen again. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. Now, without getting too technical and making this overlong, the word there for sexual immorality, which is porneia, where we get our word pornography from, that is a different word than adultery. So it would seem that the reasons for the exception clause are bigger than just adultery. But that is to go into a whole ethical subject. But Jesus is very stern here. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for porneia and marries another woman commits adultery. This is a fallen world and messy situations. We get things wrong. We do what we shouldn't do. But remember, God is a forgiving God. But what Jesus is saying here is tough, isn't it? And the disciples find it tough. And they're not sure about this. They're shocked, actually. Look at verse 10. The disciples said to him, well, if this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it's better not to marry. They've picked up the seriousness of the ideal. Marriage is a lifelong relationship between a man and a woman. But in their day, marriages could be easily dissolved by the man if he got fed up with his wife. And what the disciples are doing in this reply is actually showing that they are still infected with the culture all around them, which is a male-dominated culture. If this is the situation, then we better not get married. If we can't put our wife away for any and every reason, then let's not marry. Well, Jesus gives them a real surprise when they say that. In verse 11, Jesus says, yeah, true, but not everyone can accept this word, only those to whom it may be given. This is a really interesting teaching from Jesus here. He's saying, in a good, unfallen world, marriage really is the best thing ever, and it's God's design. But in a fallen world, for many people, singleness is actually better. That's what he's saying. Not everyone can accept this, but those to whom it's given. No, in a fallen world, singleness is often better than marriage. Where else does it say that in the Bible? Well, let me read these words to you from the New Testament. The Apostle Paul writes, now, about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think that it's good for a man to remain as he is. Are you pledged to marry a woman? Well, don't seek to be released. Are you free from such a commitment? Well, don't look for a wife. But if you do marry, well, you haven't sinned. Phew. And if a virgin marries, she's not sinned either. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life. And I want to spare you this, says Paul. I would like you to be free from concern, says Paul. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. And his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or a virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. I am saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. If anyone is worried that he might not be acting honorably toward the virgin he is engaged to, and if his passions are too strong, and if he feels he ought to marry, he should do as he wants. He's not sinning. They should get married. But the man who has settled the matter in his own mind, who is under no compulsion but has control over his own will, and who has made up his mind not to marry the virgin, this man also does the right thing. So then, he who marries the virgin does right, but he who does not marry does even better. Well, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, in case you think I'm making it up. And that's just what Jesus is saying back here in Matthew chapter 19. The disciples say, well, if that's the situation, it's better not to marry. And Jesus says, not everyone can accept this, but only those to whom it's been given. And then he gives some examples in verse 12. He speaks about eunuchs, which were men who had been castrated. And he says this in verse 12. For there are eunuchs who were born that way, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others, and there are those who choose to live like eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Now, the one who can accept this should accept it. Three categories of eunuchs: them that are born that way by nature, others who are made that way in cruelty or to play a role in the king's palace. But thirdly, and really interestingly, those who choose to live like eunuchs. They don't become eunuchs, but they choose to live like eunuchs. Why? For the sake of the kingdom of heaven. They choose never to get married for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. They choose to live like eunuchs. They decide not to get married. Jesus chose this. Jesus chose to live as a eunuch. No doubt there would have been plenty of women who wanted to marry Jesus. Hopefully I won't become irreverent here, but I mean, which woman would not want to marry Jesus? Imagine her saying from the dining room to the kitchen, darling, will you do meals tonight? Sure, you could say, I could do some nice fish and bread. Will you give me some wine with that? Yeah, how much do you want? Well, maybe that is to be a bit irreverent. Okay, but Jesus chose to live as a single man. He could have got married, but he chose not to get married. He chose to live as a eunuch. Why? For the sake of the kingdom of heaven. And that's what we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, isn't it? There are some men and women who decide that they will deny themselves marriage so as to give their time to the Lord in undivided devotion. And there are people like that in the church, the evangelical church, who have same-sex attraction, that they are a man is attracted to another man and a woman is attracted to another woman at just how they are. But they know that they cannot marry their friend who they've got real feelings for, and they cannot marry that friend because of what Jesus has said in verses 4 to 6, that God has made them male and female to be one flesh. So they deny themselves marriage because they know they can't get married. And that's sacrifice, and that's commitment. And people with same-sex attraction who deny themselves marriage can turn round to people like you and me and say, you see the sacrifice I'm going through for the sake of the kingdom of God? What's your sacrifice? And that's really challenging. There is a book I would highly recommend called The Plausibility Problem by Ed Shaw. And it's really, really challenging. It's about singleness in the church and same-sex attraction amongst Christians. And he deals with this whole issue. And Jesus says, there are some who choose to live this way for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Well, the discussion is over. The Pharisees don't come back to him. The Pharisees have been silenced for a while. The listeners have been told how sacred and committed you must be in marriage. And the disciples are left to ponder whether or not they will get married, apart from Peter and maybe one or two others that were already married. And by the end of this discussion, I suggest Jesus is probably emotionally washed out and exhausted. These things are not easy to speak about. So it's time for a little relaxation and a rebuke. Verse 13. Then people brought little children to Jesus for him to place his hands on them and pray for them. Oh, what a relief. Those proud, pig-headed Pharisees, they're gone. Let the little children come to me. It's playtime. It's his relaxing time. How did Jesus relax? These little children can make no demands on him. They didn't have any deep theological questions. They weren't going to test him. This was just pure enjoyment. He placed his hands on them and prayed for them. And I suggest to you that that really relaxed Jesus. Away from that confrontation of Hillel, Shammai, divorce, marriage, what do you think? Wah! And he silences them all and has a baby. Just you can almost, you could see it. You can almost see his shoulders just relax. Jesus was a man. Can you imagine the tension of this discussion? We sometimes forget about this. This must have actually worn Jesus out, this kind of conversation, that the tension, the confrontation. And now it's just a little baby in his arms. And he relaxes. Unlike me, if I'm holding a little baby in my arms, I'm frightened stiff, I might drop the baby. I get tense. But not Jesus. Disciples don't like it, though. Disciples rebuke them. They rebuke the parents. Oh, silly disciples. And Jesus said to them, I'd love to have seen his face. Let the little children come to me. Do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. And we saw that the other week, didn't we, when we looked at how we must become like little children to be in the kingdom of God. The grown-ups didn't like it. Maybe they wanted to guard Jesus' time. Maybe they wanted more of Jesus. Maybe they wanted to remove non-important people from Jesus' circle. But Jesus rebukes them. Look on his face, must have been a picture. And then, in verse 15, he placed his hands on them and he went on from there. It's time to say goodbye. And that's a good place to finish.